accession number 19816, Reel 3.
William Rhodes James, Reel 3.
Well, the situation at this point was, of course, that the main force, which had 17 div and so on, who'd come across country to Maitilla, were fighting their way south, and it was vital that they should get down to Rangoon before the rains came. And most of them, I think that was achieved. The result was that they cut off the Japanese 28th Armor in the armor, 28th Army, which was in the Pegu Yomas east of the main road. So they were more or less trapped and had to make their escape. This they did towards the Sitang. And if I can quote from something that I wrote about it, the Japanese commander was General Sakurai, and he said, "If you dare to do, with the determination of finding life in the midst of death, you can conquer all difficulties of superior forces, of hazardous landscapes, and of the worst climates." And with these words, Japanese General Sakurai is said to have encouraged his 28th Army, undernourished and disease-ridden, to face the daunting task of breaking out eastwards from the Pegu Yomas to cross the main Rangoon Road, heavily guarded, and the Sitang River, swollen by monsoon rain. Well, that was his problem, and we were told to move south. We joined an arrangement called Flu Force, and we were told to move south to a little town called Piu and locate Japanese who are supposed to be in villages east of the road towards the Sitang. They'd come across the main road at night and had forming up in these various villages before crossing the Sitang. We were told to go down there and deal with them. So we went down, leaving our mules behind, and came to the track which led towards the villages. By this time, the monsoon had started, and the paddy fields were flooded, and the roads, anything off the main road was just very muddy and slippery. So we didn't have any mules, and we couldn't have any wheeled transport, and so we had, I remember now, 14 bullock carts and a couple of elephants. The elephants, I think, carried the officer's mess, and I think it was the GO's mess. You can guarantee that they would be given the best spots. And we went, it was about 6 miles before we met the Japanese, and they were dug in at a little village called Weiji. And we were preparing to attack them when we discovered that they'd moved back to the big village called called Aokon. Now here they were in force, dug in under the houses, and we had a problem. However, we had field artillery, we had our 3-inch mortars, we had mountain batteries, and so we were well placed to sort them out. And the attack came in the afternoon, but it wasn't easy. And we had to fight our way step by step through the village. They had machine guns pointing down the main sort of track through the village. A lot of the houses were set on fire. I can't imagine how in that rain, but they were, and the whole place was ablaze. By the time we finally got to the far end, the village was alight. However, the Japs had been killed or driven out. We had quite a lot of casualties, including killed. And I remember, I think we counted 86 Jap corpses, but a lot more, I think, had been disposed of as villagers came back and threw them into the river. There was a colonel among them whose medals I've got. And I'm told that the force there was under the command of Colonel Yagi. It must be his medals that I've got, of a 111 Infantry Brigade.
How did you come across the medals?
Well, I took them off the body, because I had to go around looking at Jap dead and taking documents or maps and all that sort of thing off them. And this account I gave of taking this photograph of this Japanese wife, which rather touched me, because I suddenly realized, the stupidness of it all. However, Major General Magasaki, after the end of the war, said that altogether some 600 Japanese were killed in the Weiji area. It's not known how many of these fell during our operation. We counted 86, but many dead were thrown into the Chong. That was the end of that. And the Japs then just sort of disappeared towards the Sitang, and I suppose many of them did get across. I know General Sakurai managed to swim over. He got across. But a lot of corpses floated down the river. We then moved south. I think the place was called Nongli Bin. And the extraordinary thing was, I was suddenly in command of the battalion. The CO had gone off on some course, and the second in command had doing something else. And at the age of 26, I was supposed to take over command. We were ordered to move down and occupy a town called Shuijin on the east bank of the Sitang. So we did move down, I can't remember how far, and then take a track across country to the banks of the Sitang, all unopposed, where arrangements were made to ferry us across. The brigadier tried to persuade me that we should go round by boats, as there was another entrance you could do, and I said no, because I thought if we were ambushed in boats, we'd had it. So we were ferried across directly to Shuijin, and the battalion took up positions there. It was quite a big town. It had a big jail, quite a big marketplace, and on the edge of the jungle country east of that, where the hills started and where the thick jungle began. And what was happening was that the Japanese who had been bypassed further north and other stragglers were moving south, mainly through the jungle country east of the Sitang. We had one or two small clashes with them, and a patrol of the Yorkshire Light Infantry, I don't know how they got there, but I know their officer was killed by a Japanese unit on the edge of Shuijin. Anyway, finally the war came to an end, and that was the 15th of August. It was disclosed that the war was ended. So we were supposed to take in all prisoners of war, all Japanese who came in, and I arranged to put them in the jail. And above the jail I had a big notice with our divisional sign, which is the dagger, because we were known as the Dagger Division, put up. But in fact, most of the Japanese had moved further south. However, we did get in a doctor who was very nice, and we got in other stragglers, some of them carrying their comrades on their backs, and we got quite a handful of them in, and their doctor and our doctors looked after them as best we could. Next thing was to be visited by a Japanese officer. I was to tell him to go into the jungle and announce the surrender so that the remaining stragglers and other Japanese would come in. And we had a conference on the bonnet of a jeep, and he was rather a nasty man, that one. The doctor was an extremely nice person, but this man had a nasty look about him, and of course it was a tremendous shame for him to be there at all as a surrendered officer. However, I told him where we wanted him to go and that he's to go into the jungle with a couple of guides, local people, and tell anybody that was there, the Japanese, to come in and surrender. However, he didn't like that at all. He went off a little bit of the way, but didn't go properly and decided that discretion was the better part of valor. He might well have been bumped off by his own people. So that wasn't a great success. But we did finish off the war in Shuijin, and when it finally came to the end, the battalion went up to Mandalay and then up to Maimyo, where I was born.
How do you feel now about having served in the Gurkha Rifles in the Second World War in Burma?
Well, now, of course, having survived it, it was terrible in parts. I mean, I remember saying to myself, anything is better than this. I didn't mean that you know, going red or anything was better than what we're doing, but what I meant was any situation of discomfort and danger was better than what we were undergoing. So a lot of it was very unpleasant. But once it was all over and I was back in Burma again where I'd been, and I knew people there, and I met one or two friends of my grandfather's, actually, I took a platoon up through the borders of China up into Michinan and Mogong, and with a demonstration platoon, and I had some lovely fishing there. My fishing, actually, our fishing wasn't the traditional type. We threw grenades into the river and we got out the most enormous marsia, and I got an enormous rocket for that too, because I was then told by the colonel that was the best marsia fishing in the world. However, they were so big that a Gurkha had to hold into one fin and I had to put a hand through the other fin, and we used to swim them ashore. But that was lovely country, and it was very pleasant after the war was over. But the feeling I had about the war was, basically, that we were lucky to be in that stage of the war and not have been involved in the retreat from Burma, retreat from Rangoon in 42, and in the frightful battles up at Kohima and Imphal in 44. So we were really fortunate.
Did you feel any hatred towards the enemy?
Not really, no. You see, the very first man we killed, that one who was shot and all his chaps ran off, he had such a nice look about him. Pale face, nice, pleasant look. I never felt hatred. I'd never had the experience of knowing anybody who'd been a prisoner of war or anything. And, no, there wasn't hatred. He was just an enemy, as far as I was concerned. Mark you, we were sort of pumped up to think they were absolute animals, and but one began to realize that they were human beings like anybody else, and I didn't feel any hatred towards them.
Who pumped you up to feel that they were animals?
Well, all the propaganda beforehand and what we'd heard about them and their prisoners of war and what they did to people in the Chindit expeditions and so on. Killing their prisoners and so forth, and the brutality which they had been trained to do was not what one would accept. And so all this had built up into a feeling that they, and mark you, they'd never become prisoners, and you'd see the wounded ones trying to either blow themselves up with their own grenades or trying to kill us before they died and so on. So that one could not help but having some admiration for them. But of course it made it very difficult, because a dug-in platoon of Japanese had to be killed to the last man and would cause a lot of casualties.
But But were you given this picture of the Japanese beforehand by newspapers or from other source?
Well, I suppose it was, I can't remember really how, I suppose we were given lectures about them and described what they had done to, say, people who in the first Chindian expedition, particularly Berneting prisoners. I don't know where it all came from, but we got it, and I think it was partly part of the way of making people want to kill somebody else.
When you were in India, did you see any evidence of civil disturbance?
No. We went down, when I was with South Wales Borders, when I was with them after being in Nandikota, we went down to Cawnpore and we practiced operations against the civil people, but we didn't see anything in fact in practice. But there was always the feeling that there could be. And the Nepalese Congress, in fact, were getting at the Gurkhas a bit too then, because there's always this attitude of, you know, our neighbours, our friendly Asian neighbours are coming to rescue us from the domination of the British and free us from the yoke of the British Raj. And so there was always a fear that that would get through, but fortunately the Indian Army, I think in amazing ways, stood absolutely loyal, even though the disasters of Malaya and Burma in the first place might have easily made them a bit doubtful.
What made you, did you have any evidence of the Nepal Congress Party trying to influence Gurkha soldiers?
Only after the end of the war, when I know that there was some, particularly among the clerks who were rather more educated, some goings on about the fact that we'd made use of them, I think, as might be put. But most, I mean, it was only on the edge. I didn't really know. The intelligence people knew about it, but I didn't really know about it. I only felt it in a slight way with the men when we had to decide who was going to stay on and who was going to be disbanded.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, we had to cut down after the end of the war, and we had to, and there was a certain amount of selection about who should stay on and who shouldn't, and it was difficult to decide. And well, I'll tell you one thing: that the Indian Army, there was a certain amount of difficulty deciding whether Gurkhas should stay with the British at all. But eventually it was decided that four regiments, the 6th, 7th, 10th and 2nd, could go to British Army and the remaining Gurkha regiments to the Indian Army. Now, the ones that were going to the British Army were to go to Malaya. And when I was first posted to a Gurkha battalion in Malaya, 7th Gurkhas, there were 40 men in it. The rest had all opted to go to the Indian Army. And a good deal of propaganda had gone on somewhere in the background to make some of the men, quite a lot of them in fact, decide to go to the Indian Army rather than to the British Army. However, within a year or two, more recruits had come in and most battalions were up to strength. But the initial effect of the Nepali Congress propaganda had some effect on the number of people who came over to the British Army. I don't know whether I'm telling secrets which I shouldn't, or mentioning things which I shouldn't, but that is what happened. And there was some effect, because they were simple people, you see, from the hills, and they were being got at by more intelligent clerks and educated people to say, you know, they've only made use of you, these people, and they're going to leave anyway, so why not join the Indian Army? And which, so the Indians got the majority of them. And officered them very well indeed.
Did you see any action in the Malayan Emergency?
Oh, yes, yes. I was there from... I joined in 48... I went out to Malaya in 1948, when a month before it broke out, before they killed all those planters and so on. And I was there till 1958, 10 years, except I had a year at the staff cottage, 2 years staff job in Germany, so that's 3 years. So I had 7 years in Malaya, operating from the beginning, from the middle of 48, from the second part of 48, when we were right in the north. When it broke out, my company was sent to Penang, and we had to guard the banks and the jail and the docks and other key points. And then we operated in the north pretty unsuccessfully because we had no information about the opposition. And then moved further south to Bahal area. And I can't go through all the places we were at, but we were at Ypres for quite a long time and operating in the jungles around Ypres. Kuala Kangsa was a major place. That's where we really hit them hard. And they started to, I think 52 they reached their peak when they were ambushing and blowing up trains, ambushing people on the roads, attacking police stations, killing the governor of Malaya, Sir Edward Gurney, on his way up to the Cameron Highlands. And it was all a matter of them trying to get the people in the country on their side. And at that point, they were being given information by fellow Chinese farmers, fellow Chinese tappers, and so on. And so we couldn't stop them getting food, and we couldn't stop them getting medicine. We couldn't find out where they were. Then Templar came along, and he decided that all these farmers and people living out in the open should be congregated into what he called new villages. And they were surrounded by barbed wire, and they had a police station which was armed. And everybody lived inside this village. And whenever they went in or out, they were searched for either taking food out or bringing anything back that they shouldn't have done. And the communist CTs, the communist terrorists, were unable to make contact and get the information they wanted. And we started to get more and more information. And then started to really cause casualties among them until it all finished in 1958 when they gave up.
Which battalion were you with?
I was with the first six still.
And when you said you hit them hard at Kuala Kangsa, what did that amount to?
Well, it amounted to... You see, the vital thing was to get at their top men. They had organizations like an army, really, and they had camps in the jungle. And the special branch were getting more information in. And near Kuala Kangsa, they was causing a lot of damage, a lot of ambushes, a lot of killing of planters and so forth. Special branch discovered, I don't know how much detail I can go into, but special branch discovered that there was a girl, Chinese girl in the hospital who'd come in for treatment. And they found out from her that her boyfriend was in the jungle and was a part of the terrorist organization. And special branch managed to get him on our side. And so he gave us the information. And we were able to, on that, we were able to attack some of their occupied camps, but above all to ambush about a dozen of their really top ranking people. This man told us that he was going to be visited, and they would take certain track through the jungle on the way back, and we ambushed them. And then up in the north, local What are those people? Ebers? Yes, no, not Ebers. Yes, they were really.
Sakai.
The Sakai. We managed to get a Sakai on in the evening once, and they gave us a little dance using bamboos as drums, and they decided they'd tell us where there was a camp. And so they led us up through the jungle to this camp, and we attacked that, and we captured all their weapons and killed quite a lot of people, and that got rid of them. But the pressure was on them the whole time from that point on, because we knew what was happening. We had people who had given up and were telling us. And mark you, we had an officer killed attacking a camp near Taiping, which is near Kuala Kangsar. I was lucky to get away, because at the beginning of the emergency, I forgot to remember, forgot to say that when up in Kedah, we were led up the path by information that there were CTs in a certain area. I'd gone down on a course to Singapore, but the officer who took over from me was really not very clued up. He just walked up this path, and of course he was killed, and about seven men were killed. Anybody with any sense would have been suspicious and moved around another way. But all that sort of thing was happening. And eventually it began to get better. And when I was down in Sigamet, I was in a brigade headquarters. I wasn't with my battalion then. I was at what they call a DAA and QMG in brigade, and wasn't involved in operations other than knowing what was going on.
Of those operations which you described your battalion took part in, were you in any of those personally?
I was in the ambush one, because I became adjutant when I went to Kuala Kangsar, and so my colonel was Colonel Walker of some renown, and I was his adjutant, and I took part in some of the ambushes. I took part in this camp being attacked there, and various minor engagements. Nothing. There was never. You see, people sometimes say, "Well, why were you successful in Malaya, and the Americans so unsuccessful in Vietnam?" But there was no comparison. The enemy didn't have the countryside on their side, and they didn't have the weapons that the other people that they had in Vietnam, so it was really a guerrilla warfare. And it's a scrappy one. There was sort of very few, there were no set piece attacks as such. If you came across a camp, you would attack it. But, and you'd ambush people and so forth.
What do you remember, what did you actually see on that ambush?
Well, my particular role in that ambush was blocking them off as soon as they'd passed by. These top-ranking people were coming through the jungle. And in the Malayan jungle, there were these gibbons. And if anybody approached them, if we approached them, they'd start howling. And so the idea was that these people would be allowed to come through down into and up onto a ridge there, and that I was to go around and cut off their retreat, and that they would then be killed by the ambush force.